Hey, good afternoon, everybody. This is Carolyn Elephant. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I am also the creator and publisher of the website and blog, myshingle.com. It's the longest-running blog on solo and small firm practice. As many of you who read my blog know, it is not solely limited to how-to tips on starting and running a practice, although that is an important component of the site. Another important feature of the site is that I like to track ethics issues as they pertain to solo and small firm practitioners. One of the issues that I think is a huge issue for solo and small firm lawyers, and really for all lawyers, are some of the technological changes that are sweeping not just our industry, but industries across the country and across the globe. The ABA has set up a commission to address those issues. It's the Commission on Ethics 20/20, and that commission, we'll go through this, that commission was formed a little over a year ago. The commission is moving forward, doing a lot of work on various topics. They are covering the topics that we'll be focused on today are the subjects of two recent white papers that came out, but in addition to those two topics, the commission is covering a variety of other topics ranging from changes that may be needed in the regulation of attorneys due to globalization, multi-jurisdictional practice, and other issues like that. But the topics that we will be focusing on today are the subjects of two recent issues papers that were issued by the ABA Commission on, I believe it was September 20th, 2010, and the Commission has held some hearings on that, and they are also soliciting information from the public. I was a little concerned, and to be fair to the commission has, you know, this Ethics 2020 Commission is an open venture. There's a listserv that's been set up for it. The activity is being publicized. The hearings are being publicized, but there just has not been a lot of feedback really from all lawyers, and especially the solo and small firm community. The last hearing that the commission held was attended by four or five vendors, which is a little bit troubling to me, not because vendors don't have anything of value to offer to this process. They do. They have the resources to do a lot of the research on these issues. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's us solos and small firms and lawyers who are really going to feel the repercussions. And so I thought it was very important to get the word out, and perhaps, you know, rather than having people read through these two white papers, which look very intimidating, but when you read through them, they're pretty quick read and they're pretty easy to understand. But I thought that maybe just doing it in this format would enlighten people and help get the word out about what's being done. So with that, we'll get started. As I said, the Ethics Commission was created in 2009, and the intent of the commission is to perform a thorough review of the ABA model rules and U.S. system of lawyer regulation in the context of advances in technology and legal practice development. The commission's challenge is to study these issues and, with 2020 vision, propose policy recommendations that will allow lawyers to better serve their clients, the courts, and the public now and into the future. That's the stated purpose of the ABA Commission on Ethics. The website for the commission is www.abanet.org/ethics2020/home.html. And again, this is something that will be included in the PowerPoint presentation. So let's get started. As I said, the Commission's current focus now are these two issues papers. The first one I sort of refer to loosely as the social media paper. Technically, the title of the paper is Issues Paper Concerning Lawyers' Use of Internet-Based Client Development Tools. But when you read through this rule, you see that probably the largest concern are some of the more the issues posed by some of the more interactive tools like social media, or else tools like pay-per-click that are also something that are subject to user interaction. The second paper is called Issues Paper Concerning Client Confidentiality and Lawyers' Use of Technology. And though this does focus on a variety of different types of technologies, both confidentiality related to desktop use, I sort of loosely refer to this as the cloud computing paper, just because it seems as if the push behind this particular paper was the introduction of cloud computing technologies. So with that, I'm just going to give a little bit of background on why this Ethics 2020 Commission and why these issues paper matter so much for solo and small firm lawyers. I mean, first of all, social media and cloud computing have been, in my view, a gift to solo and small firm practitioners. More than anything else, these tools are leveling the playing field. They reduce the cost of marketing, and they help and they enable us to practice law more efficiently and more cost effectively, and also in a way that avoids mistakes. Through social media tools like blogging and websites and Twitter, we educate clients, we exchange ideas with colleagues, and we help to advance the law. For those of you who are following the foreclosure issues, the sort of one of the blockbuster issues has been the robo-signers. That was an idea that was first blogged about on a solo practitioner's blog, a solo from Florida. So these blogs that are out there are really playing an important role in not just educating the public, but also moving the law forward. And that's something that's really exciting and something that we didn't have access to even as recently as a decade ago. As I said before, law practice management tools are reducing law practice management costs. No longer does a solo or a small firm have to bring on an IT staff. A lot of these tools are very user-friendly. They minimize malpractice. They help keep clients involved. Many lawyers are using these tools to set up portals so that clients can stay on top of their own filings without incurring the cost of always calling the attorney. One of the things that we're seeing in this current economy and also with technological advances is really the disaggregation of large law firms. Many large firms, or sort of the larger big size firms, like 400 people, are disintegrating. We still have very large firms left, and those rates are very high. So what technology is doing is it's helping to potentially support new business models, collaborative ventures between solo and small firms that will replace some of those larger firms. I mean, sometimes you just need more bodies on a case. There's a recent news story about a legal malpractice suit against Baker McKenzie. It was brought in federal district court in, I think it was federal court, maybe state court. It was in Mississippi, and the suit was brought by one small firm, and the small firm apparently needed more people to handle the litigation, and so the small firm teamed up with two solos and a solo contract attorney. I would imagine that, you know, despite the fact that these firms were all in close proximity, that they relied on technology to interact, to go back and forth over documents. So it's an example of a situation where a larger firm was needed and for one reason or another wasn't available, and so you had this collaborative venture of solo and small firms enabled by technology. The other thing that's changing is our world, consumers and clients. Clients from consumers to large businesses are demanding ways to access legal services online. We've heard a lot about the demand for unbundled services, but even think about big corporate clients. They're integrating cloud technologies themselves. My husband has, worked for companies like Google where they, interact with each other on a daily basis over Skype, over video tools, through email, through Google Docs. And so if clients are using those technologies in-house, they're going to expect that technology to be available from outside lawyers too. And finally, the last reason why this rule is so important and why these tools are important is that we're also seeing the rise of what I call, for better words, quasi-legal providers, these companies like LegalZoom, which basically they're not lawyers. They fill out forms, legal forms. They don't exercise the type of discretion that lawyers do, but they basically have unfettered rights to advertise online. They're subject only to FTC regulations, and there's a concern, at least on my part, that real lawyers, solo and small firm lawyers who compete with these groups will be hobbled by regulation and won't be able to compete. And this is a very big danger. Again, I turn to the foreclosure crisis. We saw all of these, sham foreclosure companies that were advertising all over the place about how people could save their homes. And basically, they were taking people's money and not doing anything, filing papers that had no chance of winning, paying lawyers $200 to show up in court, you know, for a day and not do anything. We saw the difference between that so-called legal service and what real lawyers did when they deposed people and uncovered the robo-signers. So there's a difference in these, you know, in what lawyers can do and what some of these other services can do. And while I don't see any reason to regulate these services or put them out of business, at the very least, lawyers need to be able to compete in the education and advertising realm on an equal playing field. But what's most important about technology, all of these advancements collectively, they help us realize the goal of meaningful access to justice. And that's why they're so exciting. That's why the possibility is just holds so much for us. And that's why we really have to tread carefully as we move forward and give lawyers discretion to start to take advantage of these technologies and not to turn the clock back on lawyers who have been early movers. So let's now talk about what some of the concerns, and I will confess these are my own concerns about the Ethics 2020 proposals. These are some of the concerns that I have based on the work that I've done in the solo and small firm community, conversations I've had, and observations that I've made. This is certainly an opinion piece, and after this, you know, we will get down to discussing the content of these rules a little bit more objectively. My first concern is this idea of the vendor agenda and vendor agenda. As I've said before, there are many vendors that have really been leading the way for the profession in terms of coming up with technologies for cloud management, for virtual law offices, for consumer ratings of attorneys. And these vendors, in my view, have really supported the solo and small firm community and really do have resources to add value. So absolutely their views have to be included in any regulation that's made. But as I said before, ultimately it's lawyers and more importantly our clients whose interests are on the line. So it's really important for lawyers to speak up. The second thing that concerns me a little bit is, you know, to the extent that vendors have a financial interest in any of these proposals, to the extent that their pockets are going to be affected by the way these rules go, I really think that these interests should be disclosed in the comments. That's really common practice in any judicial or any formal proceeding is for people to disclose what their interests are, and I think to the extent that, you know, it goes even beyond vendors. I mean, to the extent that there's an attorney who maybe owns a lot of stock in Avvo or in some type of company should disclose that interest when they're making their comments to the commission, just in the interest of transparency. I mean, after all, it is an ethics commission, and so the highest standard should be abided by in making these decisions and conducting the comments. So that's sort of one of my first concerns. The second concern is sort of, what about clients? This is something you'll be able to see when I make the PowerPoints available. When I try to get to the bottom of sort of what a long rule means, sometimes I will Wordle it. There's an online tool called Wordle where you can basically put in all of the text from a rule and it'll spit something out, and the words that appear prominent kind of give you the main idea of what the rule concerns. Well, when you see the Wordle of both of these rules, there's very little mention of clients. There's very little discussion about the increasing client hunger for additional information or desire for client access. And what's, you know, most troubling of all is, at least to date, there's really no documented accounts of clients who've been misled online, who say that attorney said one thing on his website and I went to him and he, you know, screwed up my case and I only went to him because of what he said online. You know, typically the regulators, it's necessary for them to step in to protect the public and to address client concerns. And a lot of this really seems to be very lawyer-driven. Now, that's not to say that there's no value in revisiting these rules, but I do have some concern that a lot of this is being done somewhat theoretically, and unless and until we can get some data about clients being misled, the exercise may not be, it may not take account of the full picture. So at some point it would be nice to collect some data or feedback from clients, and whether that comes from lawyers, it may very well be that people have come to lawyers and said, you know, I went to LegalZoom and they screwed this will up for me, or, you know, this client came to me, he went to that other attorney and the website said he was going to do this and that and he didn't do it. I mean, anywhere to get this information I think would be very useful to inform this process. My third concern is that those who are making the rules aren't playing the game. I'm very concerned that many of the people on the commission don't have blogs. You know, I mentioned at least one has a Facebook page. I haven't found any on Twitter. I know that the commission is making an effort to understand this area, but the problem is that unless you're actually doing it, it's very hard to understand. And as you start to use social media and use technology, certain things that might not have otherwise been apparent to you become clear. So I think probably one of the most helpful things for this commission to inform itself would be for them to go online. They can buy my social media book if they want to, but they don't have to. You know, read, just figure out a way, if they have kids, hang out with your kids, go online with them, and just get a sense of what this world is like, because it really starts to make a lot of sense after a while, and it's very hard to regulate it out of context. The last concern I have about the regulations is that it just seems like right now they're just proposals, so the commission has not gone one way or another. But it seems that at least some of the proposals would micromanage lawyers, would take away our discretion, and that has a chilling effect. I think that really, you know, the better approach, and this is a theme that will pervade this presentation, a better approach is to really give lawyers the tools so that we can exercise discretion. This is a fast-paced world, and we're in the middle of it. We're lawyers. That's what we do. We use our discretion to advise our clients. We should be trusted to use our discretion to advise ourselves. The last concern I have about the rules we'll talk about a little bit later is that there are a lot of rules and laws already in place regarding data protection, data breaches, things like that, and I think that the rule should actually make reference to those. So anyway, now I'm going to summarize the proposals. I'm going to do this in two parts. First, we'll look at what I call, again, loosely, the social media paper, even though it addresses all tools for marketing. These are some of the topics that the commission is seeking guidance on in the social media paper. The first issue that's before the commission is how it should treat what they refer to as mixed use of social media. So for example, having a Facebook page that you use for friends but possibly also use for advertising. There's no other detail of that, but presumably, you know, maybe every night you post about a law firm victory or something on your page, clients can see it. Maybe it's construed as advertising. I'm not really quite sure what the concern is, but that's what the concern is that's identified. The second concern are lawyer-sponsored chat rooms or Facebook pages. The commission report does not give any examples. It doesn't name names. There is one law firm called the Sokolov Firm. They have this like Yaz website. I've got a screenshot of it later on in the presentation. And so that's sort of another concern, that a law firm might set up a chat room and invite people to talk about, you know, a problem that they're experiencing with a drug or a certain product that they're using, to share information and perhaps may later use that information to solicit clients or to build a case. And so that's the second issue there. The third concern that's mentioned are how to treat testimonials at third-party sites. Bar rules. Many bars right now have some sort of guidance on whether you can put a testimonial on your own law firm site. Question comes up, what happens if somebody puts it at a third-party site? Should there be rules regulating that in one way or another? Another question deals with regulation of blogs. Should they be treated as advertising? And is there any need for further guidance, further rules on this whole issue of ghost blogging that erupted in the blogosphere probably about 6 or 8 months ago? There is a commission is seeking guidance on how to treat lawyers who upload documents. For example, uploading a document to JD Supra. If you upload a pleading that you've prepared for a client, even if it's filed in court, are there potentially confidentiality issues? There are questions about pay-per-click advertising. Does it constitute an impermissible payment for a recommendation in violation of Model Rule 7.2? And then there's also a question by the commission. They want to know whether they should amend Section 7 of the Model Rules to specify that certain types of websites are subject to advertising rules. And some of those rules would be sort of, you know, the ban on deceptive communication, whether a website creates attorney-client relations, whether it constitutes unauthorized practice of law, whether you can disclose a client's identity without their consent. Those are some of the questions that have arisen. And then the last question, sort of the broader question that the commission raises, which I think is actually very, I mean, these are all important questions, but the last question, which is particularly key, is, you know, what approach should the commission take? Should it amend the model rules? Should it make recommendations to the ABA in a white paper? Should it issue best practices? And so those are some of the questions that that it has. So in a nutshell, those are the issues that are that need to be addressed through this paper. And what we are going to discuss next are some of my discussion and analysis. And again, these are just my views. I don't speak for Solos. I don't speak for anybody but me and my shingle site. But I put my ideas out there as sort of a jumping point for people to agree with or disagree or stimulate some discussion. For me, you know, these are just some overarching issues. The first thing is as lawyers, at least my own view, is that we're bound by ethics rules. There's no doubt about that. There's been some discussion about whether the ABA should be regulating ethics or ethics in advertising. And, I mean, we're lawyers. We're different. I think once we get rid of our ethics rules, we don't have any competitive edge over the legal zooms of the world. So neither I nor I suspect most of my colleagues have any problem with being bound by ethics rules of practice. But at the same time, as I said before, we need room to be able to exercise our discretion. And one of the problems with proposing additional rules or regulation to address some of this new media is it has a chilling effect on lawyers who are more ethically inclined, and it doesn't do anything to stop those who push the line. So what I mean here is that when lawyers think that the ABA or that any ethics body is going to be regulating rules in a very tight way, they shy away from it until they can get absolute certainty. And I think you see that with respect to some of the requests for ethics opinions that have been filed lately. You know, people asking very specific questions. Can I use a system like Clio? Can I, you know, use, can I set up a blog with this type of trade name? They're asking really, really specific questions that perhaps if they thought about it are already covered by existing rules, but lawyers are very fearful of exercising their discretion because they're afraid that if they're wrong, it may have a chilling effect. Currently, lawyers already assess compliance with, you know, regular activity outside of social media. For example, you know, you go to a cocktail party and, you know, you pass out business cards. That's not considered marketing in any way. It's just, you know, a part of the interaction. And you know that if you go overboard at a cocktail party and if you start, you know, going up to people and saying, hey, you got a legal problem, come down to my office, let me represent you. I mean, not only is it going to potentially cross the ethics line, but nobody is going to want to talk to you either. So there's sort of the etiquette deterrent from doing that. Well, in my view, you know, social media is very much the same. When you start to participate in Facebook, you start to understand the mores and this idea of marketing through a Facebook page, you know, that you use personally just becomes something that just isn't even really conceivable. The other thing with social media is that it offers additional protections. I mean, you know, you can't, somebody isn't going to even communicate with you on Facebook unless they, you know, they friend you and accept it. You know, yeah, you can spam people through Facebook or through email, but there's also regulations that prohibit that. So the point is that in social media, in many ways, there are many more protections for consumers. And the last thing is you know, again, most lawyers do exercise discretion. With something like uploading documents to JD Supra, yes, you know, the documents are public information, and lawyers realize that. So there's, you know, there's really no technical risk to disclosure. At the same time, many lawyers who handle sensitive cases are very sensitive about their clients. If you've represented a, you know, a person in a family law matter on, you know, charges of sexual abuse, you know, you're not going to post that on JD Supra, not, you know, because it's embarrassing to the client, but also because if you do stuff like that, other clients aren't going to come to you if you show that you have no discretion. So my point is that, you know, a lot of these issues that are addressed in the rules, lawyers already sort of have this sense. They've developed a way through practice, through, you know, interaction with colleagues, and through general senses of mores to address. So I don't think that there's any need for new rules or regulations at the point. There's also kind of what I call the Potter-Stewart test, the, you know, I'll know it when I see it. If something is advertising, if something crosses the line, most lawyers know when they see it. And that brings me to the point of the, you know, some of these third-party sites, these chat rooms that are set up to solicit, you know, clients in personal injury cases. Looking at some of those are very deceptive. I mean, you think about the real-life analogy. I mean, what if a lawyer set up a fake doctor's clinic and it had a little sign that said, you know, this is a law firm, really, but you invited people to the doctor's clinic and pretended to be a doctor and, you know, got information about their case. It would be very deceptive. I think some of these law firm-sponsored third-party chat rooms are very similar. I think they elicit information in that way. But again, it's not necessarily because there's a rule or not a rule. It's just a conclusion that I'm able to come to based on analogy, based on exercise of discretion and judgment. And so, you know, so the point is that I don't think we need to have extra rules. Lawyers can glean standards and exercise their discretion based on, you know, existing examples that have already been developed. The other thing that the rules have to take into account is that, you know, there has to sort of be awareness of how clients today are using social media. And, you know, the thing is that clients are very savvy, and I think that, you know, consumers are very internet savvy. I think that this concept of a consumer being misled, you know, whereas perhaps maybe 5 or 10 years ago that might have been true, people are now learning to navigate the internet. So when they go to a rating site, they know how to evaluate that information. I mean, they're used to using hotel sites and restaurant sites. They take everything with a grain of salt. I don't think these sites are as deceptive as they're made out to be. I don't think clients are likely to be fooled about a third-party testimonial that maybe isn't technically verifiable. You know, if a client exuberantly posts something on a LinkedIn page or Avvo saying, my lawyer was the best in the world, I don't think other clients are going to, you know, think that that's misleading and expect this lawyer to be the best in the world. They're going to see it in context that somebody else was represented by this person and was very excited to write about it. And that's the other issue that the ABA should be considering with regard to regulation of third-party platforms. And just to take a step back, the way the regulation would come about is most likely indirect. A lawyer would be required to monitor those platforms and, you know, ask to have information removed, or a lawyer might be prohibited from linking to that information. So it would work indirectly. I don't mean to suggest the ABA is going to go out and, you know, say that LinkedIn is banned. But the thing that you're also regulating is the consumer's or client's ability, their rights to comment, their rights to give feedback about a lawyer. So you have to be very careful about regulating those third-party sites because they provide an avenue for other users to express an opinion about lawyers. And to cut that off really is, I think, or discourage that in any way, I think is very, very dangerous. The one thing that I would really like to see for lawyer use with social media is really what I would call a safe harbor. As I've been harping on before, lawyers have the discretion to review these rules, but what lawyers are afraid of is that if they decide wrong, there's going to be a draconian there will be draconian repercussions. I think there should be a safe harbor for lawyers who research ethics issues before they dive in, who give some thoughtful and contemplative analysis to a particular use and then move ahead with it prudently. I think that ethics, everybody who's been reading my blog knows this, I think that ethics opinions, both state opinions and ABA opinions, should be freely available so that lawyers can actually research and make decisions about their ethics obligations. I think if you call an ethics hotline, there should be some immunization from future ethics charges. I also think that one thing that's very deceptive is, you know, this is something that came up with the Total Attorneys case. Total Attorneys is a sponsor of ABA activity, and yet, and when the ABA accepted sponsorship of Total Attorneys, it gave the imprimatur that this was an acceptable service, and that yet that didn't stop the state bars like Connecticut from going after lawyers who had used the service. So I think that just as lawyers have to be careful about services and providers who they're using, bar associations and the ABA have a similar obligation. They should not be accepting sponsorship dollars from vendors who are engaging in suspect practices. That makes things very confusing for lawyers. So, you know, I think that at the end of the day, lawyers have to be able to, we have to create an environment where lawyers can exercise their discretion to implement these tools in a way that's consistent with our ethics obligations. And I think that that should be sort of the overarching theme when the ABA moves forward. Issues like blogging, everyone knows I'm a blogger. I feel that, I don't know who, whether it was lawyers or marketers, I think we seeded the argument over whether blogs are advertising much too easily by putting disclaimers on them. My feeling has been and always will be that a blog that discusses substantive information is no different from a law journal article, no different from a newspaper column, and those forms of communication are not required to have disclaimers. I don't think a substantive blog should either. I think that there are factors in cases like Stern versus Bluestone, which was actually argued by a blogger, Scott Greenfield, and also Holzman versus Terza, which was cited in the blog post that is on the paper. I think they give a very good criteria for determining when a blog is advertising and when isn't. You can review those criteria in my PowerPoint. I won't go through them now. And then I also think that, you know, when it comes to things like ghostwriting or ghost communicating, because, you know, obviously you could have somebody who is being a ghost, you know, posting on somebody's behalf on Facebook. I think that when it's done in a personal way, in a first-person way, I think it is deceptive, and I do think it's something that should be disclosed. I think it's one thing for a law firm to put up blog posts and not indicate who authored them. But I think when you have a blog that is written by a single attorney and who signs their names to writings that are done in first person, and that attorney has not played any role in writing or preparing the content, I think that in that situation, there should be some kind of disclosure. I certainly do it as a practice for myself. I think the disclosure is necessary. You know, the ABA's concern is, and this proposal, is that without disclosure, you might be holding yourself out as having an expertise that you don't necessarily have. I don't know that for me if that's really the concern. For me, it's just this idea of deception. I mean, it's the same way you would feel if you went to a cocktail party and the firm, you know, there was a lawyer you wanted to retain and the firm sent out, you know, the handsome guy, and really the, you know, the person who you had spoken to on the phone was the ugly guy. You would feel deceived. You would wonder about that lawyer's